That's truly a big question. I was surprised that he had come to the point of asking it so early in our interview process, but Kevin was very troubled by his inability to explain how that creature had so instantly disappeared from sight. "I was watching this, and it was gone," he repeated. The open field didn't furnish any other cover between the creature's path and the still-distant oak trees. I mentioned that I'd personally heard of both dogmen and Bigfoots either flinging themselves face down into ditches or flattening themselves on the ground to avoid observation by passing humans. But Kevin didn't think this creature could have done either of those things without his having noticed. The creature wasn't close enough to the ditch, he said, and the field was too bare to hide it. The tree line that it was running along is at least 60 acres off the roadway, but maybe as far back as 80 acres, said Kevin. If that creature had been 80 acres away, that would have put it a half mile off the road. The creature was slightly in front of my position when I noticed it. I was traveling east, as was the creature. I sped up to parallel it, watching both it and the road. The wooded area has large oak trees in it, and it is fairly open, sort of like an old cow pasture. The leaves were off the trees, and the brush had died back for the year. There was good visibility in the wooded area. I made a U-turn, went back to the area, pulled to the shoulder, and watched for anything in the woods. I saw nothing. Based on the size of the wooded area and that I was driving a car, I do not know how fast I was going, but I know it was less than highway speed. This sighting lasted approximately a minute or so. Honey Lake Track Creature. His fourth and final sighting of the wolf-like creature was in spring of 2013. It didn't involve any strange vanishings, but did occur in an area Kevin already regarded as spooky, since it was near the sites of his second and third sightings and close to another very credible sighting of another type of creature. The location was in far western Racine County near Honey Lake, only a couple of miles south of the Honey Creek Bridge, where Kenosha County residents David and Mary Pagliaroni encountered a Bigfoot directly in front of their headlights in 1994. Honey Lake is only 8 miles northwest of Bong Recreation Area. I was on County FF near Academy Road by Honey Lake, said Kevin, near a railroad track that runs out of Burlington. About twice a week we get calls from train engineers about kids playing on the track right there, but when we get there, there never are any. The phantom children have been reported by railroad personnel for many years in that spot, he said. He was driving just east of those tracks when he saw a bipedal creature running across them. It then cut into a wooded area about one-fourth of a mile from where I was, said Kevin. Other than being hunched over and dark, in fur color, I couldn't see other things, like its head or arms. It was just dark. That description is a bit less definitive than those in his previous reports, but Kevin believes it was the same type of upright, unknown canine that he saw in the other events. Black cats and UFOs. I've also had an earlier report of a large black mystery animal in the Bong Recreational Area, although Kevin and Joey hadn't heard of it before their sightings. In 2004, a married couple residing in Kansasville saw on separate occasions a large German Shepherd-sized, completely black animal dash across the road on separate occasions. The husband saw it on State Route 142, which runs right through the park between County Highway J and State Route 75. That would have been almost exactly the spot of one of Kevin's sightings. The wife saw it 5 days later. Both sightings occurred after dark, and in each instance, the creature was running extremely fast, on all fours, and had a long tail. Both witnesses said it was possible the creature they saw was a black panther, but they couldn't be positive. Black, or melanistic, great cats, are not supposed to exist in North America. but it seems there are plenty of things cruising around the Bong Recreational Area that are not supposed to exist. Kevin also has spotted other strange phenomena, such as UFOs, while making his rounds when on the late shift. He saw one directly over the Dover Inn at the intersection of State Road 20 and State Road 75, about 5 miles north of Bong Recreation Area, in 2007. It was a large, bright light that floated without making a sound and then shot straight up into the sky. He saw another more recently, on September 27, 2014, in the village of Waterford, hovering above a water tower. It appeared to be a formation of red dots of light arranged in a trapezoidal shape that then moved in unison, gliding silently over the town. Kevin said that he followed it and marveled that while other motorists and pedestrians were out and about, no one else seemed to be looking at it. It also eventually shot straight up and out of sight, but not before he snapped several photos of the red lights, which he showed me. They looked just as he'd described. And as if that wasn't enough strangeness for two people, both Kevin and Joey have seen a huge reddish-furred creature they believed was a Bigfoot while vacationing in Michigan's Upper Peninsula in late spring of 2014. Kevin and Joey were riding ATVs as the creature crouched below a high power line, as if trying to remain unnoticed by staying low and still. They've since heard wood knocks and a blood-curdling scream in the same area. Kevin had, in addition, seen a Bigfoot several years earlier in Idaho, in Benoit County, and also saw another dark-furred one in Michigan in June 2015 while fishing with a friend. I visited that lake with Kevin a few months later and can attest that the spot where the creature had stood watching him was a rough and marshy place. The only way to get near that shore is to climb down a steep hill covered with treacherous boulders and then row a tiny wooden boat across the lake. The side where the Bigfoot stood has no trail or boat launch access at all. Fire ships and ancient mounds. I asked Kevin and Joey why they think they have seen and experienced so many examples of unexplained phenomena, especially the elusive upright canines and Bigfoots. They weren't sure, other than that they happen to be out and about on patrol many nights and are trained to notice the unusual. They believe hints about the presence of these creatures in this part of the country exist in Native American beliefs and lore. A Michigan Anishinaabe friend told them that his people believed the mounds found around the Midwest were created as location markers for what their ancestors called fire ships. That's an interesting term for a belief that originated before the days of modern aviation. Some might say it's also a pretty apt description of what we now call UFOs. If there really is a connection between ancient mounds, unknown creatures, and UFOs, Kevin's sightings in and around Burlington, Wisconsin, would make sense. The Burlington area is particularly rich in prehistoric burial and effigy mounds. According to the Burlington Historical Society, 27 Indian mounds were located in what is now Burlington's business district. Bones were also found on the old fairgrounds, where the Burlington Blanket Factory, later known as Burlington Mills, was built. Near Tower Hill on Storrell Avenue, on the north side of the Mill Pond, Grove Street, and near the northeast side of the Fox River, near what is now the start of the bike trail, in 1909. That is a very significant number of both animal-shaped mounds and conical burial sites. It may also be pertinent that Burlington lies only about 15 miles east of Bray Road, a spot known for its many sightings of upright canine creatures. Unknown creatures are not the only weird phenomena Kevin has experienced in the Burlington area. Our next category of anomalies will show that a green environment may mean something other than eco-friendly, and that still more oddities may lurk in the Bong Recreation Area. Encounter Case Summary. Beasts of Bong Recreation Area. Reported creature or creatures. Upright unknown canines and black possible great cat. Location, date. Southern Wisconsin area between northeastern corner of Kettle Moraine State Forest Southern Unit and Bong State Recreation Area in Racine County. Various dates. Conditions. Daylight sightings, all in clear weather from various distances. Associated phenomena. Green rolling mist, as in the next case summary. Tunnels under a state forest allegedly abandoned due to dangerous creatures. UFO sightings. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature. Unknown canines walked and ran bipedally in different locations at separate times. Witness or witnesses. Two Wisconsin County Sheriff's deputies. Environmental, geological, and human cultural factors. The Kettle Moraine State Forest area shows up in U.S. government geophysics maps as a high magnetic anomaly area. In addition, much of southern Wisconsin was once covered with large, ancient animal effigy mounds, with some remaining that are still considered extremely sacred by Native Americans. The region is filled with rivers and lakes, farmland, and much woodland, especially the geologically unique Kettle Moraine, made of deep, bowl-shaped depressions and ridges formed by the last glacier. Chapter 16. Green Mists and Sentient Atmospheres. As noted earlier, Kevin has seen other very strange things in addition to furry, upright creatures and UFOs while on patrol in southeastern Wisconsin. One of the weirdest is what he calls the green haze. A light green, translucent mist with no apparent source that he has spotted twice in 2011 and 2012. The green haze. Kevin's first encounter with the green mist was at dusk on a clear day as he sat doing paperwork in his squad car. He had parked in the gravel lot next to the expansive marsh and footpath that leads into a dark, hilly woods just north of the city of Burlington, the same wooded area where Mary Sutherland believes the Burlington Vortex is located. But Kevin didn't know that in 2011. The phenomenon that appeared to be a large area of rolling green haze was something he'd never seen before. Kevin said he didn't know exactly where the mist came from. It just suddenly appeared in the adjacent Cattail Marsh, without seeming to rise from it. The haze then proceeded to move toward him as if on a mission of its own. Kevin watched the haze, fascinated, as it began to drift in a northwesterly direction, straight toward his squad car. As the haze drew nearer, it suddenly began to affect the vehicle's electronic systems. Although the car's engine kept running, its RPM rate slowed to a minimum, and the headlights dimmed to where they were barely discernible. The computer screen blanked out, and the fully charged portable police radio appeared to be dead. The dampening effect continued as the haze changed course slightly to the north and then wafted its way up into the woods. Kevin said at that point, it simply vanished into the trees. Everything operated normally once it was gone, even the portable police radio, said Kevin. It is hard to say how large the area of the haze was, since I was never inside of it, but judging from the length of it, I would say at least an acre. I asked Kevin how long he thought the entire episode lasted, and his story grew even stranger. I do not know the time span of this event, said the officer. I never looked at my watch. However, when I parked in the lot, there was still pink in the sky to the west. When the haze was gone, the sky was dark, black, and it was near the end of the shift, about 10 p.m. Luckily, I was not dispatched to any calls at that time, since I would not have been aware of them due to the fact none of my communication equipment worked. Looking back on it now, the period that the haze was near me seemed to be a very short time span, but it seemed as though the end of my shift came too quickly. I did not realize that at the time. I base this on the fact that I pulled into the lot just after the sun had set, and it seemed as though the haze left as quickly as it showed up. At the time, this seemed as though it was a matter of minutes, but looking back on it, crazy as it may sound, it could have lasted for a half hour. I do not really know. His other run-in with the green fog also occurred in a parking lot. This time it was just east of Burlington in Fisher County Park, near the boat ramp on the south shore of Browns Lake, off Durand Avenue. The haze seemed to just appear near the marine area just west of Fisher Park, he said. It drifted to the northwest over the lake toward the island with the house on it. It just disappeared once it got toward the south end of the island. That time, no equipment was affected, and I do not know the time span of the event. It seemed to take place over a few minutes. During this event, the haze was always moving away from me. Kevin added that the haze phenomenon reminded him of his 2012 sighting of the canine that appeared unexpectedly and then also seemed to simply vanish. Looking back to that encounter, he said, I want to think I focused my vision to the road and just did not see it run into the woods, but I do not believe this to be the case, he said. It still bothers me because creatures should not vanish in thin air, and I believe this one did. Although Kevin had never heard of the green haze phenomenon before his experience, he is not the only person to have encountered it. I've had at least one hunter report the same thing. In Strange Michigan, More Wolverine Weirdness, I told the story of what one man called the Green Glow near Helps, Michigan. I believe it's worth revisiting here. Encounter Case Summary: The Rolling Green Haze. Reported anomaly or anomalies. Large green-colored mist able to move without wind and also without dissipation. Location, date. Two sites, on north and east edges of city of Burlington, Wisconsin, summers of 2011 and 2012. Conditions, near dusk, still light out, clear weather in each instance. Associated phenomena. Bigfoot and Dogman sightings in the same vicinity, along with numerous UFOs reported over the Burlington area. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature. The mists featured unusual green color, moving in a way that seemed autonomous and not due to winds or atmospheric conditions. They seemed drawn to the eyewitness in his squad car and affected automobile and phone electronic systems by dampening all equipment into a non-functional condition as the mists approached the squad car. Witness or witnesses. An on-duty county sheriff's deputy. Environmental factors. Burlington is a small city built around water, with the confluence of two rivers to its west and north, and lakes just to its east and south. It was also the site of numerous ancient Native American burial and animal effigy mounds, and many sightings of various cryptid animals have occurred in the area around the city. Michigan's Green Glow. Glenn Arntzen says that at about 9:01 morning during the 1985 deer hunting season, he spied a small yearling deer in a swamp near the Escanaba River State Forest in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, near the small community of Helps. He had just decided that the animal was too scrawny to shoot when the world around him instantly changed. All of a sudden, the swamp appeared to take on this weird greenish hue, he said in a letter he sent me describing his experience. I mean, the trees, the ground, the sky all appeared this greenish color, even the air. I don't know how to explain it. Even more weirdly, the green air seemed to affect the little deer, too. Arntzen watched as it shivered and then lay down, its head on the ground. At the same time, a wave of powerful yet conflicting emotions hit Arntzen. I had this weird feeling, one of sadness, remorse, shame, sorrow, he wrote, It was so weird. I wanted to stick my head out of my blind and look up into the sky, but I just couldn't do it. As the green hue passed over him, it rolled off into the swamp and disappeared. But as it rolled over the top of his blind, he felt it was sucking the intense emotion of sad gloom from him and replacing those feelings with a euphoric state. He said, "I had this feeling that I wanted to call out to it and say, 'Hey, wait, don't go, come back.' I was instantly very happy. Strange." The green glow's passing also affected the small deer, which leaped to its feet and dashed off in, strangely enough, the same direction that the glow was headed. Arntzen said the emotional roller coaster left him feeling for some time afterward as if he were on the verge of tears one second and then extremely happy the next. He has no history of psychological problems and has never experienced anything like it since then. A relative he confided in tried to convince him that the anomaly was caused by a low-pressure system in the atmosphere, but Arntzen vehemently disagreed with that idea. "It was way more than that," said Arntzen. "It was something else. This is the weirdest thing that ever happened to me." Arntzen estimated that while the experience should have lasted only 3 minutes, it felt more like 15 minutes, as if time had expanded inside the green glow. That's very similar to Kevin's perception of more time having passed than he realized when he was enveloped in the rolling green mist. Encounter case summary. The Michigan green glow. Reported creature or creatures. Anomalous green glow appeared in the air. Witness saw one deer. No visible unknown animals. Location, date. Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Escanaba River State Forest, about 30 miles northwest of Escanaba, November 1985. Conditions: well after sunrise, clear, cold day. Associated phenomena: possible time discrepancy. Witness felt his emotions were strongly affected. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature, anomaly. Caused deer to freeze. Made witness feel strongly that he should poke his head out of his deer blind during the time mist was visible, although he was unable to. Witness or witnesses. One male on a hunting expedition. Environmental factors. Dense, rolling, wooded area, very low population density. The Avely Mist. I was surprised to find another older account of an encounter with a green mist that included the same characteristics as the Michigan and Wisconsin cases we just discussed, especially the time discrepancies and effects on communication systems. This one occurred near Avely in Essex, England, in 1974, and was retold by Patrick Harper in Daimonic Reality. In this incident, a family consisting of two parents and their three school-aged children noticed a blue light tracking them among the roadside trees as they drove home from a social event one evening. After some minutes, the light finally stopped appearing, and the next thing they noticed was that the world around them went silent, just as their car entered a large mass of green fog or mist. The phenomenon shorted out their car's radio and stopped the engine momentarily. It seemed like only seconds until the car's engine somehow started again and the automobile burst from the fog, but when they checked the time, they could not account for over 2 hours between encountering the fog and arriving back at their house. They also discovered that their television had gone dead. The family continued to endure nightmares, poltergeist activity in their home, and weirdly, a strong aversion to meat of any kind. Harper finds a universal link between these modern encounters that result in missing time and traditional folk stories from around the world. The motif of missing time is common in folklore, says Harper, adding, Heartland calls it the supernatural lapse of time in fairyland. He also notes that a high percentage of such cases occur while the person or persons affected are riding in or driving a car, as happened with Kevin and with the British family. Even though these green mists behave too oddly to be accounted for by standard roadside fog or ground condensation, the world is full of weird atmospheric conditions. Not many resemble a spooky emerald fog, but I found one meteorological phenomenon worth examining. The green flash. There's a little-known natural trick of nature with a name that sounds like it could be similar to Kevin's and Arntzen's experiences. It's known as green flash, or as San Diego State University astronomy lecturer and researcher Andrew Young prefers, the green flashes. There are several different types of this meteorological event, Young says on his university website, a green flash page. Young takes a careful look at the characteristics of these acknowledged natural displays that occur due to complex light refraction in the sky at sunrise and sunset. His fascinating article, however, makes me doubt that green flash could be responsible for Kevin's and Arntzen's experiences. For instance, only one of the four types of green flash listed by Young can last even as long as 15 seconds. The other three types show up and then linger for only 1 to 2 seconds. The green hazes the two men saw lasted much longer than that. Also, in all four of the types of green flash listed by Young, the green or blue colors are intense rather than pale and translucent, and their positions are closely associated with that of the sun itself. Neither Kevin nor Arntzen was looking at the sun during their experiences. Moreover, green flashes do not look like giant freeform mists. One type looks like a flattened green oval atop the sun. Another looks like a separate strip of the sun. And a third is a very quick beam or ray of green light that shoots out only momentarily. Also, while Kevin's sighting did occur at sundown, when a true green flash might be expected, Arntzen's happened at 9 a.m., well after sunrise. I think that for all these reasons, the green flash phenomenon may be eliminated as an explanation for the green mists. Swamp gas and great balls of lightning. Arntzen's and Kevin's experiences involved one other common factor. Both sightings occurred within or near marshy areas. This immediately brings to mind the diagnosis of swamp gas, often used by skeptics to explain UFOs and the many varieties of anomalous light forms seen in and over wetlands, or even nearby areas. These forms may range from ball lightning to mysterious tiny points of white light to colored orbs that zip around and even chase people in cars. In some cases, the skeptics could be quite right about the gas. In other cases, they're not even close. Ball lightning, for example, is something still not well understood by science. According to weather.com, in layman's terms, ball lightning is a big flash of light that looks circular that appears in the sky during a storm. It sometimes has a blue glow and can emanate from objects like lightning rods or ship masts. In the latter instance, it's called St. Elmo's fire. Very short-lived, tiny versions of ball lightning have been replicated in the lab, but they still don't explain the natural version. And the natural occurrences of ball lightning cannot explain the green mists discussed here, since they didn't occur during thunderstorms, were not perceived as circular flashes of light, and did not emanate from any nearby objects. Swamp gas is equally questionable as an explanation for the green mist phenomenon. This term recurs so frequently in any discussion of puzzling natural or supernatural phenomena, however, that we may as well wade on into the many claims that have been made for it. The usual definition describes it as a gaseous substance composed mostly of methane discharged by rotting plant materials, especially as found in marshes and bogs. But when we try to apply that definition to the green hazes experienced by Kevin and Arntzen, it's hard to see how it explains any of the characteristics of the colored fog phenomena. Why and how would a discharge from fermented water plants form a cohesive shape of colored light that can not only travel beyond the swamp, but change directions, turn off electrical connections, and cause varied and intense emotions in humans, and perhaps also deer? Swamp gas is known by a variety of other terms, such as ignis fatuus, will-o'-the-wisp, corpse candles, jack-o'-lantern, and marsh gas, according to an article in a 1987 issue of Pursuit magazine. The authors of this article, Michael Frizzell and George Walls, added that the mystery hasn't exactly been ignored by science either. They noted, "A multitude of reliable references to and descriptions of this natural phenomenon have been found in prestigious journals such as Nature, Edinburgh Philosophical Journal, and Simon's Monthly Meteorological Magazine." Some of these references are global in scope and span the years from the 19th century to modern times. That's a lot of research. In other words, the baffling nature of swamp gas is very well known to the scientific community and has been studied in depth for centuries. The most widespread assumption has always been that the process begins when methane or another gas, phosphine, bursts spontaneously into flames, and that these flames are actually the lights people see. But as Frizzell and Walls point out, neither methane nor phosphine has been shown to self-ignite. The writers also pretty much rule out foxfire, a dim fixed glow emitted by certain fungi found on deteriorating logs, and discuss both ball lightning and the darting glowing orbs called ghost or spook lights at sufficient length that we may conclude these luminous wonders also fail to match what Kevin and Arntzen described. Interestingly, the so-called ghost or spook lights found at certain locations do share a couple of characteristics with Kevin's green mist and Arntzen's green glow, in that they, and UFOs, seem to move willfully, or at least independently, and that, as Kevin discovered, they are often reported to interfere with electromagnetic devices and vehicle engines. But let's have a look at how well they match up in other ways. Spook lights of Michigan and North Carolina. Some of the best-known recurring ghost lights in the Midwest, the Paulding lights at Watersmeet in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, bear much testimony affirming their reality from eyewitness encounters over many decades of display. I believe there are two different types of lights visible there on most nights. One type is undeniably explained as the head and tail lights of vehicles on the slightly distant hilly State Highway 45. Those were, alas, the only type showing themselves the night I was there to investigate them in 2006. But there is a second, very distinct type of lights that are said to show up regularly at this site. Red or white orbs, or other colored light shapes that lurk in the woods, pop back and forth between the wood line and the parking lot, and finally zip right through parked vehicles, where they may turn engines, headlights, and radios off and on like a switch. I heard more than a dozen such reports firsthand, once as a guest on a Wisconsin Public Radio member station in Wausau, only a couple of hours' drive south of the Michigan location. For a solid hour, caller after caller described such interactions with lights near or in their car, some even saying they were chased by the lights. And not one caller claimed the distant highway lights were the only luminous objects present. Numerous other examples of people's experiences with the Paulding lights can be found on various online paranormal sites, and in Weird Michigan, your travel guide to Michigan's local legends and best-kept secrets. I'll share just one example from that book. It came from an Illinois woman named Lori, who was 27 when she wrote to me sometime around 2006. She and her husband had recently heard of the lights from friends and traveled to the Paulding site near Robbins Pond Road to see for themselves. They arrived at about 10:30 p.m. and didn't have to wait long before a small glowing red light appeared above the trees to their right. As they watched, she said, it jumped away and then returned several times. On its last return trip, it began executing zigzag maneuvers and then suddenly blossomed out into a larger, brilliant white light that moved closer to Lori's car before fading away in what felt like a farewell salute. As happens with many ghost light sites, there have also been weird creature reports from the Paulding area. Two are included in Strange Michigan, More Wolverine Weirdness. One occurred November 11, 1985, on Robbins Pond Road, when two brothers saw three hairy, brown-furred creatures walking upright through the dense roadside brush. They estimated the height of the largest at about 6 feet, while the other two were markedly shorter at between 4 and 5 feet. The main feature the brothers noticed about the three beasts was that they all had very long arms in proportion to their bodies, and that they swung their arms vigorously as they passed. The brothers didn't report any interaction between themselves and these creatures, which sounds very much like typical descriptions of Bigfoots, and rather as if the creatures were on a mission. The other report dates all the way back to 1958. This daytime sighting was not of a Bigfoot, but something much less commonplace. A white, upright, man-sized rabbit. Or at least something that resembled a rabbit. The eyewitness was the mother of a credible middle-aged woman named Lil, who told me about her mom's experience, emphasizing that her mother was not the kind of person to make things up or joke about something like that. Lil said her mother was working outdoors in the forest off Choate Road between Paulding and the little town of Bruce Crossing when she suddenly came upon a 5-foot-tall animal covered in white fur that she thought looked like a giant rabbit. The creature immediately took off into the forest in true loping, bipedal fashion, not bounding or hopping as, say, a kangaroo would do. Its size and ability to run upright make me think of an albino Bigfoot or Dogman, but that's not how Lil's mother saw it. It doesn't sound like any known natural creature I can think of either. I did see one large, hairy, brown creature cross the gravel drive to the parking area on my own visit to the Paulding lights, but it was only a bear, lumbering across the gravel road that cut through the woods. Still, I interviewed perhaps a dozen of the 40 or so other people there and learned many of them were repeat visitors who said they had also seen the close-up, independently moving type of lights on other occasions. Baffling Brown Mountain. One of the most famous light phenomena sites in the United States, however, is the Brown Mountain area in North Carolina's Blue Ridge Parkway in Burke County. The history of these lights stretches back to the first European explorers in the early 1770s, and perhaps even earlier among the region's indigenous people. There are the usual legends, of course, that claim the lights emanate from ghosts of tragically killed humans. The very same claims and similar legends are associated with the Paulding lights. Many have also tried to account for the Brown Mountain lights as some sort of natural phenomenon, outgassing of minerals in the terrain, reflections and mirages of lights from area cities, traffic and trains, and the always cited swamp gas. Again, the same explanations have been offered for Paulding, but in both cases the history of the so-called spook lights precedes steam locomotives, automobiles, and electrified cities. Those familiar with the lights say none of these ideas can fully explain the glowing round balls or small points that sometimes float up into the sky. Tom Burnett and Rob Riggs in their book Bigfoot do offer another suggestion. They believe, based on their combined years of interviews and research, that Bigfoot is tuned into and able to manipulate biologically based electromagnetic fields, a view increasingly shared among other researchers. They write, We further believe this energy can appear in a concentrated or focused form as unidentified mystery lights. Such strange luminosities are present in the area Tom has studied in the form of the Brown Mountain Lights, and in Rob's study area as the Bragg Road Light. They also note, what is not so well known, although it was consistently reported by such pioneering mystery primate investigators as Keel, Persinger, Swan, Slate, and Berry, is that such disturbances are also frequently associated with mystery hominids. Emphasis mine. This association is virtually ignored by current organized research groups, but it strongly implies that ghost lights and Bigfoot are causally related. I think we can add upright furry cryptids in general to this proposed causal relationship, and perhaps the hazy mists as well. It's time to examine another related phenomena that we have alluded to, but not yet fully discussed. Chapter 17. The Oz Factor. The multitude of reports of brushes with UFOs, strange lights, and anomalous mists received by contemporary researchers show there are more of these incidents than most people would suspect. A surprising number also involve apparent missing time. Author Jenny Randles coined her own term for that effect in her 1983 book, UFO Reality, A Critical Look at the Physical Evidence, calling it the Oz Factor, after the magical land imagined by novelist L. Frank Baum. Randall's discussion referred to UFO witness reactions to these occurrences, but much of her commentary could apply just as well to cryptid witnesses. Zones of Influence. Randles noted in an article in the June 2004 MUFON UFO Journal that, at least when it came to some of the more personal sightings of UFOs, there appeared to be a zone of influence surrounding these close encounters. What she meant by zone of influence is that those who get close to the phenomena often have the sensation of being enveloped in some sort of energy field that shuts out normal perception of the workaday world. She went on to add, for instance, there were claims that at the onset of the episode, all ambient sounds faded away. Birdsong, the wind in the trees, distant train noises, etc. Other characteristics attributed to the Oz factor include the appearance of an enveloping colored mist in the immediate surroundings, similar to our green haze encounters. Sharp emotions that may alternate between joy and sadness, just as Arntzen experienced. A sense of physical immobilization, and conflicting perceptions of measured versus perceived time elapsed during the incident, as experienced by Kevin. Some have likened the Oz factor to a psychological state called derealization, defined in most medical dictionaries as a sense of detachment to one's surroundings, or the belief that the outside world has suddenly changed, isolating the experiencer. Implying that it's mostly an effect of one's own gray matter, doctors often then link derealization either to schizophrenia or simply to the mind's response to a traumatic situation, as the brain tries to shut out distractions in the face of danger. While I think it's more logical to presume the latter, in my 20-plus years of interviewing people who've had these experiences, most appear to be normal, healthy folks who simply saw something unexplainable and often wish they hadn't. The Zone of Fear. Instances of the Oz factor don't always occur with visibly colored surroundings or even a mist. Sometimes people just come across a place that feels extremely weirdly different for no apparent reason. Noah Voss, a longtime investigator and author in Madison, Wisconsin, shared his encounter with a suddenly changed environment for My Strange Wisconsin, More Badger State Weirdness. He called it a zone of fear. As Voss told it, he and his friend John were taking a casual evening stroll through Greenwood Cemetery in autumn of 1999, talking and laughing about their favorite TV show. They had just taken a turn onto the path that led toward the oldest part of the cemetery, said Noah, when both of them stopped in mid-stride. As they stood there on the path, a sudden sense of dread overtook them and blotted out all other thoughts and sensations, striking them both dumb and motionless for several moments until the feeling passed. As soon as they were able to talk again, they confirmed that they had simultaneously perceived the same thing, which Voss felt as an all-encompassing sense of evil. Voss described it as a sudden swing from an easy, jocular mood to one of instant fear so intense that he nearly became sick to his stomach, and John felt paralyzed. Both felt their hair raise up on their necks and arms, and had an overwhelming urge to run from the area as fast as possible. Intrepid investigators that they were, the men forced themselves to walk back through the terrifying zone to see whether the effect remained. It had evidently moved or disappeared, since this time they felt nothing out of the ordinary. Voss also noted that they saw no mists, orbs, other people, or animals in the park at that time, just the headstones and themselves. When they returned to the park on another occasion, intending to measure the spot's energy levels with various instruments such as electromagnetic meters and compasses, the readings registered as normal. Voss said they had never experienced anything like this event in the cemetery before that night, and never did again. And yet he remains convinced that what he and John felt was very real, especially since he and his friend's perceptions of it were identical and simultaneous. Locked in dread. They are not the only people ever to have run up against this type of phenomenon. Researcher and author Jim Sherman wrote about his own very similar experience in Facing the Big Hairy Monkey Thing. He told of an incident that occurred while he was working as a camp counselor in Kalamazoo County, Michigan, the summer after his high school graduation. Sherman recalled that he was strolling back to his cabin by himself late one evening, enjoying the stillness of the lake, when he began to hear something walking along with him in the woods, lining the dirt road. It stopped when he stopped, but stayed hidden just inside the tree line. Thinking it must be one of his friends trying to scare him, he was about to dash after it when he was hit with a blast of freezing cold air. But it didn't feel like normal air. It was as if it had mass to it, like the air could really touch me, wrote Sherman. I saw nothing, but I felt this coldness. That was not the worst part of the experience. The cold lingered, but then another sensation took hold, dread. I was filled with the most powerful fear I had ever experienced. I could not move. It felt as if my legs were locked in place. I stood there because I couldn't do anything else. All I wanted to do was run away. Then it stopped. All of the sensations that had been assailing me were gone. The question, of course, is what sort of entity, energy, or phenomenon could produce such an extreme reaction without visibly showing itself? Of course, Sherman's wielder of dread may have been visible had Sherman been able to lay eyes on it, or if he'd been carrying a thermal imager. He did, after all, tell this tale in a book about his encounters with Sasquatch. But he never said he believed it was definitely Bigfoot that made him feel this way. Even if it was a Bigfoot, we still must ponder how a flesh-and-blood primate could accomplish such a thing without possessing some wild talents in the areas of telepathy, infrasound beaming, or extreme camouflage technique. Of course, there are plenty of researchers who believe Bigfoot possesses all these attributes and more. Noah Voss and his friend, on the other hand, weren't given the slightest clue as to the nature of whatever gave them such horrific willies. Since the experience occurred in a cemetery, it would have been natural to blame some sadistic spirit for frightening them, but there was nothing other than the location to suggest a paranormal entity. One investigator, D. Scott Rogo, proposes in The Haunted Universe that perhaps the fear of imminent evil that hit these young men is a genuine psychic force in its own right. He recounted yet another example of people suddenly gripped with unexplainable terror, this time two brothers, alone in their family home in Denver in 1938, simultaneously felt unexplainable dread and fear, along with the conviction that a hideous presence was in their house and that it wished them evil. Rogo believes that whenever two people are identically affected like this, or as in the case of Voss and his friend, it helps confirm that more than a simple panic attack is at work. As Rogo noted, while I have heard, of course, of people with free-floating anxiety, I have never heard of a case where two people shared the attack. Rogo then cited and ruled out several possible but unlikely psychiatric explanations for the sudden perception of great evil in a particular location, and continued, "I think we have to conclude that the man who told of the experience actually did confront something evil, something from which he knew he must escape." This loathsome thing was only ephemeral, however. When the brothers ventured to re-enter the house later that evening, its atmosphere was perfectly normal. And that, of course, is exactly what Voss, his friend, and Jim Sherman all discovered about their zones of fear. The incapacitating phenomena swept over them and then moved on or disappeared, showing these zones to be transient in nature. But here's another that lasted a bit longer and also involved some bonus phenomena. It, again, involved an adolescent male, a characteristic that is beginning to seem like another pattern. Good entity, bad entity. The first account I ever heard involving what I now believe to have been an Oz Factor experience was told to me in 2005 by Christian Page, a writer for the Canadian paranormal TV show Northern Mysteries. The ordeal was a true life-changer for him. He has since written 5 books on unexplained phenomena in French, and the experience is included in a soon-to-be-released, at time of this writing, English translation of L'Encontre du Paranormal, tome 1. The incident occurred when he was 13 years old and living in a rural area of Quebec, as he walked alone on a road one night at about 10 p.m., Page helped refresh my memory of his story via email. He said that as he trudged along that night, he approached a bend in the road and, to his horror, saw the headlights of a car racing toward him at top speed. He felt that he had no chance to outrun it, and it went through his mind that he was about to die. But just as the vehicle was about to plow into him, he felt himself being somehow physically lifted into the air, floating above the speeding auto as it passed beneath him and then continued careening on around the bend. Guardian angels? Not quite. His less-than-excellent adventure would also prove less than heavenly. As the car's lights receded into the distance, he felt himself being slowly lowered to almost ground level, his feet stopping a foot or so above. And then something, or some things, began to carry him into an adjacent cornfield. He had the sense that there was an entity of some kind on either end of him, one lifting him by the shoulders and the other grabbing his ankles, and he could feel the up-and-down motion of their individual footsteps. He could not see them, however, and it seemed as if the outside world had gone silent. He felt, he said, as if he was inside some kind of bubble that blotted out all the normal sounds of insects, birds, and other noises of nature. The one thing that he could hear was the voices of the two beings as they argued over what to do with him while marching ever deeper into the field. The one holding his ankles kept insisting they should kill him. Page wrote in a recent email to me, "Strangely, the voice was coming at the same level of my ankles, about 2.5 feet in height. It's why I always referred to this entity as the dwarf. I could hear his voice. It was his real voice, not something like telepathy. This invisible entity was speaking French without any foreign accent. The voice was a bit strange. It was like if the entity was talking while gargling." The other voice, Page realized, was not coming from the entity that held his shoulders, but from a third entity that seemed to be walking ahead of them, from a height he estimated at about 6 feet above the ground. This voice was similar to the dwarf's. Same French, no foreign accent, and same gargling, said Paige. The second voice was repeating. In response to the dwarf who was repeating, "We will kill him. We will kill him." "No, we will just scare him. Just scare him." He was unable to struggle or move during this terrifying interlude that he estimated took about a minute and one half total. And then suddenly it was over. Evidently the no-kill entity had won the fight, because the young man found himself unceremoniously dumped onto the dirt in the middle of the field. He could hear the sounds of nature again, and ran as fast as he could for the road. He made it safely home and did not notice any discrepancies between the time the entities carried him through the field and how much time had actually passed. But weird as the encounter may have been, none of its aspects are without precedent. These entities, for instance, make me think of hobgoblins, fairies, or various Native American legends of little trickster people. They did save the young man from being hit by the car, and at least one of the unknown voices wanted to let him go. Why they bothered to carry him into the cornfield is anyone's guess, but perhaps it afforded more privacy for their consideration of his fate than did the roadside. The disruption of all natural sounds indicates this was indeed a classic case of Oz factor, which ended as soon as the two arguing voices left the area. There's also the mystery of the invisible state of the creatures that were nevertheless able to perform physical tasks, such as lifting and carrying Paige. I do receive similar reports now and then, and we'll examine several other unseen entities in chapters to come. We will also look at a Bigfoot encounter in which a man described its garbled language, reminiscent of Paige's description of his captor's voices. It was also especially intriguing that one speaker was very close to the ground, while the other voice came from at least 6 feet above it. Were they different sizes, or was the voice 6 feet above the ground flying? My mind begins to conjure an image of two little people, led by some type of tall, perhaps hairy, humanoid. All three of these beings were solid, but invisible, and they exhibited an inordinate interest in the young Paige. Paige told me 10 years ago in our first conversation that his desire to explain this occurrence propelled his lifelong interest in all things paranormal. I can understand that completely. And I believe he was very lucky that the taller entity had its way. Perhaps something like this otherworldly kidnapping is what's happening to all the folks author David Pilates keeps documenting in his Missing 411 series about those who vanish in North America's natural areas. An alliance of invisibles, each with its own inexplicable agenda. Chapter 18. Mist Eerious Creatures. As I mentioned in the introduction, for almost 2 years I've been working on another Wisconsin case with repeated sets of large, 4.5-inch canine prints that do inexplicable things, such as appear suddenly in the middle of a secluded field, then track off into nearby woods. The prints usually appear bipedal, although it's good to keep in mind the fact that wolves and bears will both step precisely into the prints they've already made, sometimes creating what appears to be one single deep print. I've heard from professional trackers in northern Wisconsin that both animals can even do this walking backward for at least a few steps. The prints in this long-term research project, however, also indicate a creature with the ability to prevent the capture of its image on multiple trail cams, despite the evidence of paw prints showing it was there. Various types of cameras aimed at this bait have caught weird mists and anomalous lights overhead, however, in daylight and nighttime, all of them, so far, unexplainable. The investigation is still in active progress, but I'll admit it has me questioning some of my own previous biases at this point. The fact that the lights appear in tandem with the unexplained creature tracks may not be proof positive of a relationship between the creatures and mysterious lights, But I believe that since lights, mists, and creature prints often appear in the same time and place, searching for a connection is the logical next step. Willies of the Field. Let's jump back to this book's introduction and revisit those prints that seem to have dropped into